All right. So today we'd like to welcome Richard on from the band OAR to the Hear Us Out podcast. OAR is a platinum selling rock band in the US that sold out MSG, Red Rocks multiple times and a bunch of venues in between. And thank you for taking your time to be with us today.
Very kind of you to say. Happy to be here.
All right. So the band just wrapped summer tour. You just finished up with Ocean's Calling in Maryland, released a single with DJ Logic and Brady Watt. So why don't you tell us about what's going on with the band, what you've been working on?
Wow. Aside from that, we've been chipping away at making a new record. We've got a bunch of ideas that we're trying to finish and make sure they're right. And I think the goal is to have a collection of songs to choose from going into 2026, which is our 30-year anniversary. So, you know, it's always nice to have more than enough songs, and you can just start pulling the best and just kind of putting together the songs that make the most sense together to tell a story, to create a body of work.
Do you feel like the way you all create albums that it's worked on in the studio first, or things are developed on the road and then they're fine-tuned and finessed in the studio?
It really varies. You know, it's a good question. There's not really a formula of what comes first or you know, an exact process of an order of operations for writing a song. There's ideas that come during sound check. You know, we're just jamming and not all the band is on stage yet, and so we're just kind of noodling around because I'm on stage with Michael Paris and we got there early, and we're just playing some ideas, and then next thing we know we're hitting the audio record on our iPhones and putting that idea down. You know, so it can come from that. It could come from me just being in my home studio, just usually working on something else, but then have an idea of whatever I'm not working on, and I'll record that. Yeah, I think it varies. It can also come from like a concept, right? A lyrical concept of, I want to write a song about this. Like, for example, Peace. When we went in to write that song, Mark wrote it with Nathan Chapman, who's a very talented producer, singer-songwriter.
He's worked with Taylor Swift, is that?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He did all of Taylor's like old stuff. And we went and wrote a song with him, and he just walked in the room, said, I want to write a song about peace. And literally a half hour later, that song just actually appeared. Yeah.
And with that song specifically, did the melody follow the lyrics, or one way or the other, was it all just kind of made together?
There was the idea, and then there was kind of this guitar riff. And I think that guitar riff sparked some melody, and just, you know, when you're in a room with really talented songwriters and really talented lyricists, things just start flowing, right? You're just kind of talking it out, and then when you start talking it out, you start finding little nuggets that you start gluing together.
Do you find the magic happens more commonly with the song, with the lyrics, or with the melody first?
So in like my personal world of writing, lyrics to me hasn't always been the focus. Like I'm always focused on the music. So every song that I've written, it's always been the music has come first. I might put down a scratch vocal just to put down a melody that I'm hearing, maybe to inspire, if once I hand it over to Mark for the actual quality lyrics. But my lyrics are usually just like kind of placeholders to fill the space. And then those are temporary most of the time. And then, you know, it's Mark who would really come in and fill the story into something that he can relate to, because he's the one who's singing it, you know.
So you had mentioned the magic happening, and Speaking of that, I'm thinking of during live shows, what I've noticed is a lot of times during your first solo, toward the end of it, you reach over, hand a pick over to a kid in the crowd. And I'm very curious the origin of that, where that's rooted, because one of the themes we've examined on our podcast is becoming a part of people's stories. And having seen this up close, it makes for what seems to be a magical night for the family that's involved in that. So I'm curious about that from your perspective on stage, how that is.
Sure, and just you bringing that up makes me smile because it brings me back to the time where this all kind of started. So, like you said, Love and Memories. I've got a big rock guitar solo, which is something that's always fun to play. After the solo, I give the pick away. I usually find a young kid in the crowd, and who's close by because I'm attached to a cord. And I can't always get over there, but I try to find the closest one and someone who seems pretty engaged in the show. So that all started when we were first playing our first weekend of festivals in probably 2001 or 2002. I'm sure the internet will correct me if I'm wrong. But we had it was the first time we had a tour bus. We had a weekend of shows. We were still full-time students at Ohio State University, but the band was buzzing, and we had an opportunity to play three festivals: Midtown Music in Atlanta, Memphis in May in Memphis, and I believe Nashville River Stages was the other festival. I'm pretty sure these are all still going on. These festivals are still going, but giant festivals, huge headliners. The stage that we played on was headlined by Lynyrd Skynyrd, and they were closing the set. Of course, we were probably the first band to go on that stage at like 1 p.m., whatever it was. You know, our fans showed up. It was incredible, just to be in a festival setting. And of course, we took advantage of, just having access to, backstage and seeing all the other bands play. Somehow during Skynyrd's set, they let us go into the pit between where the security stands. Oh, there's a stage, security, and then there's a railing, and then that's where GA is, right? So I'm pretty sure it was Freebird. I'm pretty sure it was Freebird, but I was standing in front of Gary Rosdale and one of the guitar players for Skynyrd, and he's ripping his Freebird solo, and I just remember being in awe, standing in front of him with my mouth open, just kind of pinch me moment, right? And after he finished playing it, he looked directly at me and he took his guitar pick and handed it to me. And I think he saw that I was very engaged in what he was doing, thoroughly enjoying his shredding. And he gave me that guitar pick, and that left a positive imprint on my brain for the rest of my life, to the point where just talking about it makes me smile. So something as simple, and he probably thought nothing of it. You know, I don't know if that was something that he did on the regular, but he gave it to me, and for whatever reason, and something that simple of giving me a piece of plastic that probably costs, less than a nickel to make, brought so much joy to me and such a great memory that realized that something simple like giving a kid a pick on the stage will probably, be a pretty positive.
Moments to remember.
Yeah, there was a show this
And
summer where there was a little girl near me, and you gave her a pick after that solo. And then there was a point later in the show that Mark tossed her a pick, and she was there with what I assume were her parents. And the entire show, they're all glowing. And it's so clear that that is now a story for them. That's not going anywhere. Like, I can remember back to being a kid, the first baseball I got at a Yankee game. I was 11 years old. You remember those things. So I think it's really cool that you bring that to your shows and give that to your fans in a way that you don't have to. You're doing that because you know you're getting to create a moment, and there's something really nice in that.
Yeah, and I think there's memories for like even like you just saying, I remember you giving a pick too, and even the people who are around it who see it happen, you know, I think it's you're trying to create moments throughout the show, and you're trying to create memories, you know, and you know, anything that we can try to, and we're not faking it, generally want to make a kid smile, you know.
Now, with this big anniversary coming up, how is it for you to have watched it, the band evolve over so long?
You know, this past tour that we did was our first headlining tour in 5 years. The last headlining tour we did was 2019. COVID hit. And then we went out, we did a co-headlining with Dispatch, and then we went out supporting Goo Goo Dolls. So it's been a while since we were able to kind of really stretch our legs and play full 2 hour sets and be able to fit in rare songs, the hit songs. Obviously, Crazy Game of Poker found a place every night in the set list. But the feeling of that people are still coming out to spend their time and money with their families to come see us play after 29 years, 28 years of being a band, you know, it's just lots of gratitude. You know, there are times we walked out on stage and we just kind of, I looked at Mark just really surprised, like, I can't believe how many people are here to see us play, right? That feeling of that surprise, that spontaneity of being genuinely surprised of how many people are still coming to play, just really gives you a more enormous sense of gratitude for still being able to do what we do. Looking back of how far we've come from, you know, playing shows while we were still in school, you know. I think the evolution of the band musically is, you know, it's hard to be in tour shape and playing tip-top shape without being on tour. When you're not on tour, you're not playing music 2 hours a day, right? I'm not playing guitar, I'm not running through songs. So towards the end of that, not the end of the tour, probably within a couple of weeks of that tour, we were really firing on all cylinders and really kind of just being a fan listening to the rest of the guys play. Like, man, these guys are so good. Like, they sound so good. And I think as we get older, I don't want to say OAR is like a fine wine, but like we take it more serious because we're so thankful. And we really we understand as family, you know, guys ourselves, we really understand the commitment that it takes for someone to come out and choose to spend money and time on a show. It's not just like, you know, our fans are just, you know, oh, just pick up, oh, you want to go to this, you want to go to that. They have to plan these things out. They have kids, they have lives, you know, probably very busy lives. So yeah, the evolution of the band, I think along with our fans, has really pushed us to put on the best show we possibly can because we are so thankful that people are willing to spend their time and money to come see us play.
So you have, we talk a little bit about the moments that are created for the fans, talk about the gratitude that you all have in still doing this. I think of shows I've been to, and a couple moments really stand out. So 23, 24 years ago, there was a Dave Matthews show at Giants Stadium, and they're in the encore, so it's the end of the show. The sky exploded. Rain, thunder, lightning, hail, the kind of thing that would shut things down immediately now. But then it's like, hey, you're standing on a metal grate. Who cares? It's this magical moment where you hear the lyrics shift and start talking about rain because it's so wild. 8 or 9 years later, I hear an interview when Giant Stadium's closing up where Dave is talking about that. So you have this magical moment created on stage organically. A couple of years ago, we're at a Trey show, and it was when James Casey was dealing with his cancer. He comes back on stage for the first time in a long time. And That was an incredibly deep emotional moment for the audience, for everybody on stage. And I'm curious for you, in all the years you've been doing this, those magical moments that are created that just kind of happen, if you can speak to being a part of that, if there's something for you that stands out in the time that you've been doing this of like, whoa, that was a moment.
Yeah, I mean, of course, forces of nature are things that you can't control. And when you are touring in the summertime and playing outdoor venues, it is bound to happen. One very fond memory is when we were playing Chicago, Northerly Island. I'm not sure if it's still called Northerly Island, but it's this outdoor, beautiful venue. It's right on the water, it's in front of Soldier Field. It's pretty amazing, and we decided to record a live record there. And to record a live record, you have to bring out lots of extra equipment. It's very expensive. We had a mobile recording truck, hired a lot of people, running cameras, because there's a video aspect to it as well. And weather was looking good, but you never know. The drop of a dime, the storm
On the
started
lake,
shifting,
sure.
and next thing we know, we are the storm hit pretty hard, and we thought we were going to have to cancel the show, which would have been devastating. Musically, obviously disappointing for the crowd. Financially, it just would have been really, really rough. We postponed the show. It rained. It came down pretty hard. We thought the storm wasn't going to leave. It was still lingering, but we got approval from whoever approves that stuff. You guys can put on the show, but we're going to have to watch it. And if lightning strikes again, we're going to have to call it for another half hour and wait it out and see what happens. So we went back up, and we played the show, and there were moments where the storm kind of tickled in, but then it left just enough where we could keep playing, and we were able to successfully, put that record out. And then we named it Rain or Shine, because of that moment. But there are times where things like that happen, and the lyrics, like you said, and musical moments just kind of line up with what is going on. Whether it's something that's going on in the world or a storm, or those moments are just magical. When you talk about like capturing lightning in a bottle, that's what that is.
Absolutely.
And music and live performance, that tends to happen a lot.
Now, in all your time of doing this, when did you start using in-ear monitors? When did hearing healthcare start becoming relevant for you?
I probably didn't use them early enough, but I thought in the beginning that was just what, you were just used to having your ears ring after a show. I'm actually very surprised that I don't have as much hearing loss as I would expect, considering some of the shows that we played. Early on, you're playing small stages. The drums are literally right next to you, right? There's a cymbal just crashing in your ear. And that was just something we got used to. I think we started wearing earplugs, just trying to drown out the sound. I remember putting one earplug in because I still wanted to hear the live feeling. I wanted to hear my guitar amp.
Like that's the most common where you have one in, one out.
And you were plugging Chris's side because he was to your right.
Yes. And at the time, I used to be on stage right. So he was on my left. This was like
Okay.
really early on. I can't quite remember why we switched. Maybe, I'm not sure when that transition happened where I went to stage left. But I do remember my left ear just going to hell. So I used to plug it, and then I used to have one ear out, and then we couldn't afford in-ears at the time. We knew that they were out there, but the idea that you had to get something molded and custom fit, it just sounded expensive. I don't know if we really looked into it, but it was just like, this is working just fine the way that we're doing. Eventually, when that became a feasible option, and we got molded, I absolutely hated it because I felt like I was so inside this box. And I
Hear that a lot.
couldn't feel the energy from the crowd. I couldn't feel my guitar. I felt like it wasn't exciting for me, right? So then we started kind of experimenting with, keeping one ear out. We also had, I think Sensafonics had an ambient system where you could blend in some ambient noise with it. And that made things a little better too. But even to this day, I think the guitar for me is the most important part that where I need to feel inspired. My guitar has to sound good to me. If it doesn't, I have a really hard time just faking the funk. Because what the crowd is hearing is different than what we're hearing, right? Because it's a totally different mix. Some guitar players can just kind of assume that, oh, I sound good out there. It's fine. I can sound bad in my ears, but I sound good out there. For me, I'm not mentally strong enough to convince myself that that's the case. So, I keep one ear out so I can still feel the air of my amp moving, and it still sounds like a guitar tone to me. I think we made that transition probably around 2002, 2003. I'm pretty sure when Skinner, when Gary Rosendale gave me that guitar pick, we were not using in-ears. So I'm kind of basing it off that time.
When you met with an audiologist or somebody to discuss this, did they ask you specific questions about where you stand, who's around you, what your specific needs are, so that they can get you the right product?
Yeah, I mean, it was mainly our monitor guys who were saying, hey, you guys should try this, you should try that. And we've had a, different monitor guys over the years. And it was something that was very new to us at the time, we didn't, I don't really remember a in-depth discussion about what was the best thing for us. I think it was more relationships with the monitor guy who had relationship with Sensaphonics or another company, where that was where the connection was made. It didn't get really specific. It was just like, oh, we're gonna mold these, we're gonna try these, you're gonna, this is the brand, and this is what it is. I think if there was probably more conversation about that, then there wouldn't have been such a shock for me trying them for the first time. We're like, I hate these things, this is not, I didn't sign up for this,